welcome Wolfgang Tumu, more or less?
Yeah.
Okay. German, terrible. Who's an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Parma, who's written extensively on philosophy of literature, especially the kind of philosophy of literature he'll talk to us today about. Philosophy of literature, Wittgenstein and literature as well, and phenomenology of perception. Quite a lot of really good papers, not all of which are accessible in English, but perhaps will be translated in the future, as well as a book, The Constitution of Consciousness, a Study in Analytic Phenomenology. And before I get started with the talk, I just want to thank the British Society of Aesthetics for its funding for the London Aesthetics Forum series. And now I'll pass it over Wolfgang for his talk on bringing literature back into the philosophy of literature.
Thank you very much. As you can tell from the title, I want to speak about the philosophy of literature and in particular about the fact that there's something wrong, but not terribly wrong. The philosophy of literature is evolving a lot lately, and judging from the amount of recent publications in the field, in particular to that of readers, textbooks, introductions, handbooks, and companions, it seems safe to say that the philosophy of literature is about to become a self-standing philosophical discipline. Over the last 4 or 5 decades, the interest in works of literary fiction that philosophers, especially from the analytic tradition, broadly construed, have shown, has evolved into a delineated area of study, or of discourse, if you prefer, that is characterized by its nearly exclusive focus on a relatively small set of clearly circumscribed questions and problems, which incidentally are often presented in form of paradox. We can probably distinguish two phases. In the 1970s, there were a lot of short articles, for example, John Searle, The Logical Status of Fictional Discourse, David Lewis, Truth in Fiction, Van Inwagen. But this was also the time when Jakobson wrote his influential paper, Who is Less Considered. And then we have a second phase in the philosophy of literature, which is in the 90s, where we have full-length books by people who have really an interest in literature. And for example, Walton, Peter Lamarck, and Olson, and then these people shape it to become a discipline. The narrowness of focus that we still find today comes from the fact that this discipline finds its origin in a handful of short contributions by philosophers, that is Searle, Lewis, and others, by philosophers who mainly worked in other philosophical disciplines, typically philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, and metaphysics, and they often apply theories that have been developed in different contexts to literature, or to works of literary fiction. I don't think we should regard the narrowness of perspective as a limit, but a necessary liberating move. It's a good thing. The relation between philosophy and literature have been very close over the last 2,500 years or so, and so it's very difficult to talk about the relations between philosophy and literature in a general and comprehensive and well-structured manner. So you have to focus on a certain set of questions. What I think is more problematic is that often the way in which these questions are approached does not, at least not prima facie, reflect a genuine interest in literature. When in the early days philosophers from the philosophical from other philosophical disciplines have discussed works of literary fiction, they have often considered them as special cases or borderline cases where things don't work the standard way. In fictional contexts, proper names typically do not refer. Propositions do not turn out as true. It is not clear whether our emotional reactions to fictional characters can be considered genuine, and we do not ascribe properties, and we do ascribe properties to fictional entities even though they do not exist. This in turn shows that any theory of proper names, emotions, or an ontological theory on the fabric of reality, that claims to be universally valid should better be also be applicable to the hard cases, to fictional names, to proposition in fictional context, or compassion for fictional characters, or shed light on the ontological status of fictional entities. This has given way to the tendency that, rather than discussing the central question, the question that I consider central, why literature matters, and why do we, or why should we care about literary works of art, the contributions that have shaped the debate in the philosophy of literature from early on often pursue the main goal of showing the universal validity of a theory that was originally developed in different contexts. We might regard it as a symptom of this tendency that for a long time, philosophers working in the field did not show an interest in engaging in detailed discussions of the literary qualities or the salient features of literary works of art, but focused nearly exclusively on fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes or Anna Karenina, and a handful of examples of narrative fiction, often some novels by Jane Austen. As the abstract theoretical points presented were complex, it seems they wanted to keep the example simple. It's a very limiting thing for somebody who's not grown up in the English-speaking world, because I'm not so familiar with these works, but have a different set of references, as you will notice later. But then it wasn't so hard to follow, because I didn't know Sherlock Holmes. This characteristic of philosophy of literature has brought about a consequence on which I will focus today. Most problems that have fascinated philosophers, especially in the analytic tradition, are not related to the literariness of the works in question, but rather to their being works of fiction. So far I've always talked about fictional literature, but it's not. As a consequence, the focus of attention in this young field is drawn towards problems related to not to literature, but to fiction. This is sometimes made explicit. We speak of the paradox of fiction, or the debate on the ontological status of fictional entities, but also Searle and Lewis use the word fiction in their titles. But we find the bias towards fiction also in contexts where we should expect it less. For example, in the discussion concerning the cognitive value of literature, on which I will focus today. One can gain the impression that philosophy of literature is nothing but philosophy of fiction in disguise. This is not per se problematic. I'm not saying this in a polemic mood. There's nothing wrong in doing philosophy of fiction or sharpening our philosophical intuitions with examples borrowed from literary fiction. Sometimes it can be interesting even to apply a theory that has been developed in another context to works of fiction or literature. We should be aware, however, that this strategy does run the risk of losing out of sight what, at least according to the name, should be at the center of the discipline's attention, literary works of art. I'm not making these remarks with the intention to open the debate on the right title for the discipline that we now know as philosophy of literature. I do not want to argue about words today. I rather want to suggest that due to this bias towards fiction, the philosophy of literature runs the risk of leaving important questions unaddressed and of not seeing solutions that would be more obvious if it would focus on literature rather than fiction. In what follows, I will illustrate this point by focusing on the debate concerning the cognitive value of literature, that is, the questions of whether literary works of art can impart relevant knowledge on the reader. Among non-philosophers, it is considered a commonplace that literary works of art can and should play an important role in one's education or formation. In the recent and not so recent debate in the philosophy of literature, however, this commonplace is put into question. We find this already in Plato or in Hume. Anti-cognitivists argue that we cannot gain any relevant knowledge from literature. Note that their arguments are typically based on the observation that propositions contained in literary works of art are not literally true, nor justified, nor affirmed by the author. They are based, in other words, on the observation that literary works of art often are works of fiction. The argument that I want to sketch today is based on the idea that we need to carefully distinguish fiction, the notions of fiction, from the notion of literature. So I would like, in a first step, characterize this difference, the difference between these two notions. It is important to note that the terms fiction and the terms literature are not synonymous. This point is not new, it's not original. The distinction is familiar in the debate and is sometimes even expressed explicitly. John Searle, for example, does so in his famous article, The Logical Status of Fictional Discourse, and points out that his is an, and I quote here, attempt to analyze the concept of fiction but not the concept of literature. It is not possible, he continues, to give an analysis of the concept of literature. And there are three reasons for that. So he suggests you can give an analysis of the notion of fiction, but not of the notion of literature. First, that there is no set of traits that all works of literature have in common. These are Searle's points. Second, the term literature refers not to an internal property of texts, but rather to an attitude we take towards them. And third, there is no sharp boundary between literary and non-literary. After all, he says, literature might be a family resemblance notion, and so we cannot come up with a clear-cut definition. I think he's right. I think that these three points show important difficulties for an analysis of the notion of literature and might explain why the task of giving an exact definition of the term has proven so challenging. And in fact, there is no good definition that I know of. There are a lot of attempts to define the notion, but none of them has been really successful. Interestingly enough, however, the notion of fiction shares the same difficulties. Here we have an analogy between the two. As a matter of fact, each of the three of Searle's points that have been made for literature can be made for fiction and have been made for fiction as well. Stacey Friend, for example, has argued that there are no necessary and together sufficient conditions for fiction and concluded that fiction was a genre, a super genre. Kendall Walton has suggested that the central aspect of fiction is that we take a stance of make-belief towards the text. And Derek Metravers has argued recently that the distinction between fiction and non-fiction is gradual, not sharp. And there are other examples, but just to give you these three. Not that each of the three persons agrees on each of the three points, but each point has been made concerning fiction. This shows that John Searle has not convincingly shown why we should privilege an analysis of the notion of fiction over that of literature. Both are difficult to define. We could as well talk about literature. John Searle is right, however, to insist that we need to distinguish the two notions, for they are not coextensional, that is, they do not refer to the same entities, nor do they have the same intention. That is, even when they refer to works of literary fiction, they refer to them in different ways. The terms fiction and literature are not coextensional, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, because there are many works of fiction that are not works of literature, and vice versa. Movies, comic books, jokes are fictional, but not literature. Speeches, letters, autobiographies, and some novels are, for example, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, and many, many poems are not fictional, but they are works of literature. This is a point that was already made by John Searle. But even when we speak of works of literary fiction, where we have coextension, even if we restrict our discourse on this, the two terms refer to different aspects of the works. When we use the term literature, we suggest that we are speaking about a work of art that is made up of words. The term fiction, on the other hand, suggests that the work does not purport to faithfully represent an aspect of reality, but invites the reader, or the beholder, if you want, to imagine the events described. Not all works of fiction need to be literature, as we have said. The difference is, in my point of the difference that is in my point of view most important, though, and this is a point that is hardly considered in the debate, is that the term literature, but not the term fiction, is used in an honorific sense, or in an evaluative sense. I've inserted evaluative in the last moment before coming here, that's why I was a bit late. I'm not sure. I have the feeling that in English the word literature is used mainly in a honorific sense, while in other languages might be used in an evaluative sense. What I mean is both mean that you can evaluate the work, but English speakers, as far as I know, are reluctant in calling literature a really bad work of literature, while German speakers would say it's still literature, but it's bad. But it's one or the other. This becomes particularly evident when we negate it. If one says of a text, this is not literature, one typically does not want to suggest that it is not a novel or a poem, but rather that it's a poor work. And somebody might think, well, it's still literature, but bad literature, or someone might say it's not literature at all. A work of questionable aesthetic quality, sorry. It is different with the term fiction. If one says of a text, this is not fiction, one does not suggest that it is of poor quality, but rather that the persons and events described are real, more or less. The difficulty to exactly pin down the difference between literature and fiction is related to the problem of coming up with an exact definition of the terms. This is due, among other things, to the fact that the conception of literature and that of fiction have undergone, also due to the fact that they have undergone considerable changes or evolutions over the centuries and might differ from one culture to the next. At my example, that the German term Literatur might have a slightly different use from the English word literature is an example for that. We, in Germany and Austria, there is no distinction between fiction and non-fiction in bookstores, for example. But there is novels or belletristik and Sachbuch, which would be non-fiction. Even if we were to restrict the term to the way it is used in contemporary English and disambiguate it, that is, we make clear that we, with literature, we intend not all printed texts or a list of scientific publications or a specific topic, but literary works of art, the difficulties remain. John Searle is probably right when he suggests that it is a family resemblance notion. So we'll not try to come up with one more definition of the terms. For the sake of this paper, for the sake of today, and in a rough approximation, I think we could characterize them in the following way. The term fiction refers to those aspects of a text or another form of representation that bring about its having a somewhat distorted relation to reality. And I won't specify what that means. But I guess you have a grasp on that. And the term literature refers to those aspects of a text that display the author's aesthetically relevant choices in an act of written communication. And here I'm already anticipating something I will elaborate on further. I want to say basically that there is an aesthetic dimension to it. And this aesthetic dimension is closely related to the style of a work, to stylistic elements of a work. And the stylistic elements are the results of aesthetically relevant choices. But I will come back to this point. I would like now to talk now about the cognitivism debate. We have seen above that the anti-cognitivist line of reasoning is building on the first aspect, that is, the fact that many works of literature have a somewhat distorted relation to reality. It is thus an argument that should be particularly relevant to the philosophy of fiction. But then we deem works of literature cognitively relevant, and so we should also discuss it from the point of view from philosophy of literature. Against this line of reasoning, I want to suggest today that if we focus on the literary dimensions of the works in question, we can undermine the cognitivist line of reasoning and bring aspects at the center of attention that make evident that next to other forms of value, literary texts, qua literary works of art, can, but not necessarily do, have also have cognitive value. When the anti-cognitivists develop the line of reasoning, they typically take it for granted that there are texts that are cognitively relevant. So no, these are typically not skeptics who say we cannot learn from written texts at all. They just say we cannot learn from works of literary fiction. They are typically ready to admit, however, that readers of non-fictional texts, like scientific textbooks or newspaper articles, for example, can absorb the information that is contained in the text and so come to know things they did not know beforehand. The anti-cognitivist argument is based on a model of cognitive progress that ties cognitive progress to the communication or transfer of true information. I think we could call this the phone book model of cognitive progress. I was tempted to call it the textbook model, but then I realized it doesn't work for textbooks, so I thought that was inappropriate. For here, in the phone book, we have an example of a book that contains mostly true information. Let's take the most recent phone book, of course. And this information can be transferred directly onto the reader and so enrich what we might call her knowledge database. So cognitive progress through reading phone books. Also useful information when you want to call someone. This model seems clearly insufficient, however, and it does not even work for textbooks. Imagine a reader who learns a textbook by heart, let's say a textbook on quantum physics, but does not understand a single sentence written in the book. There are people like this, some of them take oral exams in Italy at my university, and you realize they can answer all the questions, but the way they answer, it's an automatically reproduced text, and there's no understanding going on. So our person might be able to reproduce the exact definitions of a boson or a superstring, but we would not attribute knowledge to her. Merely absorbing true proposition does not suffice if understanding is missing. So just getting the propositions from the textbook is not enough, you have to understand them. But the problem runs deeper. It is quite likely that many, if not all, textbooks we use today will prove wrong or inadequate in the future. Scientific progress often consists in overcoming an old theory and substituting it by one that seems to be more adequate or more faithful to the facts. We don't talk about phlogiston anymore because we think that there are better ways to talk about the world. Let's assume, and I hope you can come along with me, that's a wrong example, it's a simplification, but let's assume for the sake of argument that with his theory of relativity, Einstein has shown Newtonian physics wrong. I think it's much more complicated than that in ways that I don't understand, but let's assume that this is how things are. In this case, all physics textbooks that have been written beforehand, before 1905, did not contain true information. Does this imply that the physics textbooks that had been written beforehand did not have any cognitive value? I guess the anti-cognitivist would have to bite the bullet and argue so. And you can say that. No one has ever learned anything about physics before 1905 because the information contained in the books was false. The interesting thing is that Einstein has learned all he needed to know about physics from these textbooks. By studying the supposedly false proposition contained in Newtonian physics, he came into a cognitive position that allowed him to elaborate his theory of relativity and to prove Newtonian physics wrong, if my simplification holds. To be sure, young Einstein could not gain propositional knowledge about the physical universe from the old textbooks, if by knowledge you mean true justified belief, because the propositions were not true. And this is the main reason why these textbooks are considered obsolete nowadays and are not used any longer. However, Textbooks are not mere and unstructured collections of isolated propositions. Phone books are, but textbooks are not. They're rather, and even phone books have a structure. You cannot learn a lot from that. They rather present them in a certain form that highlights the structural relations to one another within an overall theory. The very specific way the propositions hang together constitutes the theory. That is, a certain image of reality emerges from these formal aspects, from the way the propositions hang together, and offers explanations for various aspects of our physical environment. Moreover, when actually paying attention to these formal aspects and to the way in which the theories are developed, readers can acquire knowledge concerning the forms of scientific argumentation and on the methodological approaches that have been applied. This knowledge is not explicitly formulated in the textbook, but it is implicitly present. If you want, this is what a textbook shows but does not say. There needed to be a reference to Wittgenstein today, so. To be sure, these aspects are not transferred on a passive reader. It takes an active engagement with the text and the capacity to critically engage with it. Only a reader who is able to focus on relevant aspects that are related to the form, not the content of the textbook, can come to know how research is done. They learn how propositions are justified, how arguments are developed, and how theories are structured. We've seen so far that the anti-cognitivist line of reasoning We have seen so far that the anti-cognitivist line of reasoning is based on a model of cognitive progress that is problematic and adequate only for a very limited range of cases where the communication of specific information counts. The discussion concerning the cognitive value of textbooks, be they outdated or not, has shown that the cognitive value often is related to aspects that are not said explicitly in the text but shown in the form. What does that mean for the cognitive value of literature? Anti-cognitivists often point out that literary works do not contain arguments, nor do they justify propositions. So it seems that we cannot apply the same line of reasoning that we just had to literary works of art. I want to suggest today that the fact that the term literature, unlike the term fiction, is used in an honorific sense is the key to this understanding. When we call a text work of literature, we suggest that aesthetic value can be attributed to it. We speak of literary works of art. The aesthetic dimension of literature is often neglected in the philosophy of literature. Many philosophers probably think that it is the domain of literary critics, but not of philosophers. And maybe they're just like me, afraid of entering this domain. Moreover, many of us do not want to engage in discussions on the aesthetic qualities of specific works, but prefer to approach the question on a quite abstract level. We don't care about the cognitive value of this or that novel, but we want to see what literature can do for us. But we do not need to discuss particular works. We can ask in an abstract way what constitutes the aesthetic value of a text. What makes a text a work of literature? At first look, one might think that membership to literary genre is a distinguishing characteristic. One might suggest that typically we pay attention to the aesthetic dimension of a text when we are aware that we are reading a novel, a poem, or a short story. And I think this is a good ad hoc approach, because this is what happens when we go into a bookstore or when we read the newspaper. This cannot be but a heuristic device. However, the genre distinction is not clear-cut and under constant change. Authors often do not respect these distinctions and play with the genres or aim to introduce new genres. Moreover, a definition along these lines would lead to a descriptive notion of literature, and cannot thus do justice to the honorific use of the term, so it doesn't work for us. The answer I want to propose is that we attribute an aesthetic quality to texts that distinguish themselves from others, to texts that are in some way outstanding. We do not normally consider grocery lists, business letters, newspaper, or scientific articles, or trash novels, works of literature. What they have in common, and even in German, it's, trash novels are a border case. Even there you would say it's bad, it's literature, but bad. You would be reluctant of using the term literature. What they have in common is they typically exemplify a strict and rigorous schema of composition that is blindly adopted by the author in the production of the text. If you write a grocery list, you don't pay much attention to the form. You focus exclusively on the content, I assume. As a consequence, the author does not need to make any relevant choices that will have an impact on the work. In other words, the author's choices do not become manifest in the text. In cases where an author leaves the schema behind, however, her choices do become manifest. Recently, the German comic has published a book with grocery lists that he found in front of supermarkets. A strange person, he would run around the supermarkets and find the shopping lists, grocery lists that people would throw away after doing the shopping, and he put them together in a book. And then you might be able to appreciate the formal differences between the different ways of making a grocery list. But typically this is not foregrounded in the text. Only when the schema is left behind, the choices become manifest. If often the text would be considered unusual for a specific text genre, ideally it will be called innovative. In both cases, the aesthetic dimension of the text is foregrounded, to use a structuralist term, or at least the English translation of Aktualizice, I think, in Czech. In short, it's an author's style that turns a text into a literary work of art, independently of its genre. With this, I do not want to suggest that every text that breaks a convention is aesthetically valuable, of course. I do want to argue that it is a necessary condition for qualifying as a candidate for aesthetic evaluation. Texts that deviate from a norm might be perceived as excellent, but also as clumsy, superficial, naive, ineffectual, or just bad. This suggestion that I've just sketched might sound too general and too little specific. It does not allow for an individuation of internal properties of texts that render them works of literature. Moreover, it depends essentially on conventions and on the reader's expectations. To say that texts have aesthetic value if they do not adopt pre-existing schemata of compositions in a given text genre renders literariness a relational property rather than an intrinsic property. So we don't find something in the text, in the linguistic material of the text that we could pinpoint. I do not think this is a problem, though. Texts can be outstanding for many different reasons, and I'm convinced that there is no formula for creating or recognizing aesthetic quality. Aestheticians in the 18th and 19th century had thought so. They thought that you can learn to become a carpenter and you can learn to become a poet more or less in the same way. You just have to internalize a set of rules of production of the end product. We have overcome that. Moreover, I'm happy to accept the consequence that our conceptions of what counts as aesthetically valuable and even on what counts as literature might change over time, should the reader's expectation change. When I nonetheless place much emphasis on the deviation from a norm or standard, I do not want to suggest that deviation is always aesthetically relevant per se, but rather that it makes the author's relevant choices in the process of writing manifest. It draws your attention to it. My point thus is this, that the aesthetic quality of a text depends on the way the author writes, on the choices she makes in the process of composition, choices that are relevant as long as they become manifest in the text, to avoid intentionalism. And when they deviate from a norm or violate the reader's expectations, they become particularly manifest. The notion of style has often been tied to formal aspects of a text, to the choice of vocabulary, grammatical structures, or rhetorical figures. In quantitative stylistics, it has been defined as the idiosyncrasies of a person's way of speaking, and Rowling was uncovered to have been the author of A Cuckoo's Calling by an analysis that focused on how often the words the and of were used, and how often specific strings of three or four words would occur in the text compared to other similar texts by the same author. There are computer programs who can do these things. Nowadays, the form content distinction seems difficult nowadays, to say the least. In philosophical aesthetics, it has often been pointed out that literally every aspect of a text, as long as it can be recognized as the result of a conscious choice by the author, can be regarded as a stylistic element. In this perspective, literary style is not reduced to choices that become manifest in the form or linguistic material, as it were, that is used in the composition of the text. The words, the punctuation, the figures of speech, but can also be connected to choices that determine what is often called the content of the text. Let me give you two concrete examples. And here I have taken the liberty of using an example that is closer to my home. Thomas Bernhard's novel, The Extinction, takes the form of an inner monologue. And in this book, tyrants, characterized by repetition and exaggeration, hateful tyrants, become stylistic elements. And then I will shortly talk about another example that you might be more familiar with than I am, Lawrence Stern's Life and Opinion of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman. Digression becomes a stylistic element. Thomas Bernhard's novel, The Extinction, takes the form of an inner monologue of the main protagonist, Franz Josef Murnau. I don't know whether you know the text or have read some other text by Thomas Bernhard, which would be amount more or less to the same thing. The protagonist, the narrator, is a fictional character who writes the text with the goal to not to affirm or immortalize himself. It's kind of biography, himself, his own memory, or that of his family, but to extinguish or erase it. That's why it's called The Extinction. So the text is edited by another person who says, I found this manuscript because Murnau has extinguished him all and eradicated all memory of the world with this text. This was his declared purpose. Throughout the text, the protagonist comes to speak of many different topics, and he speaks of all of them in the same obsessed and angry manner. The book is full of polemic tirades on all kinds of topics. These tirades are characterized by a strong tendency of repetition and exaggeration that culminate in cascades of words that show a strong musicality as the rhythm of language becomes dominant. And this is what makes the book wonderful to read. He develops a musicality, a rhythm that reminds a lot of serial music with the repetitions, and it's just an aesthetic experience you have when reading it. And I don't know how well it transfers in translation. I know that in Italian translations it doesn't work that well. I don't know about the English ones. In his book, exaggeration becomes a stylistic element. And in one of the cascades that typically go over several pages, but I give you a short passage, the narrator praises the art of exaggeration, culminating in the phrase, exaggeration is the secret of great art, I said, and of great philosophy. The art of exaggeration is in fact the secret of all mental endeavor. I now left the Huntsman Lodge without pursuing it, this undoubtedly absurd idea, which would assuredly have proved correct if had I developed it. On my way to the farm, I went up to the children's villa, reflecting that it was the children's villa that had prompted these absurd speculations. And here, this I've taken this passage because it's something Josh Landy has recently called a manual for the readers. It's a passage rather late in the text where the reader gets a key of how to read the text. because the exaggeration start at the beginning, but at some point the author explains why he has done that. And this happens also in Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy about digression. Also here, towards the end of the book, in one of his numerous digressions, the author talks explicitly about his art of digressions. For in this long digression, which I was accidentally led into, as in all my digressions, one only expected, there is a masterstroke of digressive skill, the merit of which has all along, I fear, been overlooked by my reader, not for want of penetration in him, but because it is an excellence seldom looked for or expected indeed in a digression. But it is this, that though my digressions are all fair, as you observe, and that I fly off what I am about, as far as off and to as any writer in Great Britain, yet I constantly take care of order to order affairs so that my main business does not stand still in my absence. But this contrivance, the machinery of my work is of a species by itself. Digressions, incontestably, are the sunshine. They are the life, the soul of reading. Take them out of this book, for instance, you might as well take the book along with them. Digressions and exaggeration are not normally considered formal elements, but they clearly, or elements that have to do with the linguistic material, but they clearly characterize the literary style of the two respective works. In short, we can say of both that if one would take them out of the books, one would take the book along with them. To be sure, both books are novels, and as such, works of fiction. Neither Franz Josef Murnau nor Tristram Shandy have ever existed, and everything we read about them is not true in the literal sense. Murnau was not really born in Wolf's Egg. Tristram Shandy's father's intention was not really to call him Trisgeminus. We may, of course, make believe all these facts, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it seems to me that this exercise in imagination is not essential for the understanding of these two novels. When in The Extinction we read sentences like National Socialism is the greatest blight on Austria, along with Catholicism, or that writers are on the whole the most repulsive people, I told Cambretti, or that photography is the greatest disaster of the 20th century, we can imagine Franz Josef Murnau, a broken man with a troubled relation to his family and his home country, making these affirmations in his conversations with Cambretti, another fictional character, to be sure. But if you want to grasp the meaning of the work and understand its significance, we need to follow the manual for reading, as we had above, and pay attention to the force of the exaggeration, the tirades in which an affirmation is radicalized until it turns into its own contradiction and thus extinguishes itself. And this is the topic of the book. It's the extinction. It's doing something and taking it away again with the same stroke. Only in this way can we understand the work as an ambivalent play between autobiography and anti-autobiography, historical novel and literature, as it was suggested. The fact that both books find readers still today, many years after the death of their authors, is due to the aesthetic quality that makes them outstanding. And this aesthetic quality is due not to the fictional aspects of the work, but to not to what is said, but to how it is said. Style has often been characterized in many different ways, as the author's signature, Goodman, or as an expression of the implied author's personality, Robinson, and there are other proposals, although I do not agree with all the details of these proposals. Personally, I find it most promising to define style as the manifestation of the author's choices in the composition of a text. I think that both are right in suggesting that the stylistic dimension of a text contributes essentially to the meaning of a literary work of art. If we perceive a text is aesthetically valuable, our attention is directed towards its stylistic dimension, and so, indirectly, the author's choices in the composition as they become manifest in the text. The exaggerations and repetitions in Thomas Shandy's Extinction and the digressions in Sterne's Tristram Shandy make emerge a very particular perspective on some aspect of our shared world that emerges from the text. When reading the text, we come to take this perspective into consideration. Very likely we come to wonder what reasons have determined these choices. The perspective that emerges from the text might be quite different from our own or quite similar to it. It is not important whether we share it or not. What counts is that in any case it invites us to reflect, to get it, to know a different perspective and to confront it with our own perspective. In this way, literature can enrich the reader at a cognitive level if the reader plays along and accepts the invitation. In the perspective that I want to present today, all these aspects are not tied to the fact that novels describe persons who have never existed and events that haven't taken place. I do not want to suggest that it is the content of the text or any dimension that is tied to its being a work of fiction that enriches us at a cognitive level. It is rather the aesthetic dimension of the text that draws our attention to the author's choices in the composition of a text, very much like the poetic function of language as it was described to members of the Prague Circle, most notably by Roman Jakobsen and Jan Mukhajovsky. Just that the attention is not drawn to the linguistic material, but to the author's choices in general. So I think we need a broader idea of poetic function. Of course, sometimes the author's aesthetic choices are tied to aspects that are traditionally identified as content. Naturalistic novels, for example, distinguish themselves from other novels by choices regarding their content, the portrayal of ordinary people or people who live in precarious situations. Incidentally, even fictionality or non-fictionality of a text can be the result of an aesthetically relevant choice of the author. Take Truman Capote's In Cold Blood as an example. My point is not that only the form but not the content can be of cognitive value. I rather want to suggest that the cognitive value is tied to the aesthetic dimension of the text, that sometimes can comprise aspects we attribute to the content, as this aesthetic dimension draws the reader's attention to the aspect to aspects that are significant for it, the meaning. It is a consequence of this view that we need to reject the idea that the cognitive value of literary works of art can consist in the transmission of true information. Authors of literary works of art do not enrich us at a cognitive level by stating truths, nor do they present arguments, but rather by inviting us to consider a certain perspective that emerges from the stylistic dimension of the text. Authors can only submit to the reader's attention what they think is relevant, but the readers are free to decide whether they want to accept this invitation or not. Moreover, it cannot be but an invitation to reflect, but it's up to the reader which conclusions they want to draw from that. So I think that the cognitive value of literature, of literary work of art, is the result of a process that actively involves both reader and writer. To conclude, I have tried to argue today that the philosophy of literature should show a more vivid interest, a more vivid and genuine interest in literature. It can do so only if it pays due attention to the aesthetic dimension that is too often ignored in the debate. In particular, I have tried to suggest that the debate concerning the cognitive value of literature should greatly benefit from this turn. Literary works of art can be of cognitive value, I've argued, not because they allow the author to share her own beliefs with the reader, but rather because they allow the author to make a specific perspective emerge that can stimulate the reader to reflect. It is important to keep in mind that the readers are autonomous, rational agents. As such, they are free to believe what they think appropriate. The phone book model of cognitive progress cannot do justice to this aspect. What is most important to keep in mind is that this is tied to the aesthetic dimension of the text. And at the end of the day, we must never lose out of sight that this dimension is what counts most in literature. It's the aesthetic dimension that counts. Reading a literary work of art ideally gives us aesthetic satisfaction. If by doing so, it also proposes us interesting insights, so much the better.